So hello and welcome to another episode of ID Cast. I mean, it really can't be said enough. I hope everyone out there is staying safe and, more importantly, staying sane. My name is Brad Harper, and I am an industrial design recruiter. I've had the awesome privilege of working with some, you know, some really great companies. I mean, the idea behind this podcast was to, or is to, spark that kind of next level of conversation within industrial design. Amida and Emma have been, you know, really humbled by the positive messages and comments that we've had so far, which has been really great. Today, episode 4, we're joined by Tom Malloy, senior product designer over with Oxford Product Design. Tom was one of the early hires over there to a team which is now 20 plus strong, very much a traditional kind of multidisciplinary product design consultancy. Lockdown's hit, but you know, OPD seems to be as busy as ever, so we get to grips really with why that's the case, as well as talking about the mental health aspect of design, which is particularly prevalent as we recorded this last week, which was Mental Health Week. So if you do want to get involved, or we just want to, you know, share your views on the pod so far, then drop us a message. Feel free to email hello@designtruth.co.uk. We'll happily take a look and get back to you. More importantly, go grab yourself a beer, get yourself in the garden if you can, and enjoy. Thank you. I like the fact you're doing the podcast right. You've got yourself a Corona. For me, that's always a good start. Drew's got his bottle of reds. You know, I've got the Estrella. This is how you start a proper... Yeah. You start a proper podcast. I'll just introduce you, Tom. This is Drew and Emma. I don't know if you've spoken before in the past. I know it's a small world with these things. Tom works for a design agency called Oxford Product Design. Is that right, Tom? You're still there?
Yeah, it's correct. Yeah, for about 7 years now. Coming
up to. Bring our listeners up to speed. We've now got a listener in the Philippines, by the way, which is great. And we are truly international now. We have two listeners in Tokyo, and we have a listener in the Philippines. So bring these people up to speed with who Oxford Product Design are and what they do.
Yeah, sure. So we're a small design agency, started up in beginning of 2013, and we deal primarily with physical product design. Really is kind of, you know, like what people go to university for, to go and train. That is the work that we do, looking at objects.
You know what, that makes me so happy to hear. The paranoia that creeps in when you do a search about what's product design? Apps. The answer is apps. Yeah, go on, sorry, carry on, I interrupted.
No. The thing always confuses me now, as well as you see, if you ever see like a job advert for a product designer.
Yeah.
Now, sometimes you'll just read them through out of curiosity, and I don't understand half the words, and you realise, they're talking about Python and C++. And I don't know this stuff.
Yeah. Or for banking, like product design now, like a lot of the adverts that I see and things like this go, oh, your profile matches this, because I'm on LinkedIn, so you get the email straight into your inbox about, hey, this thing matches your profile. Like, I don't know a thing about banks. And I know there's the whole notion of if you can design one thing, you design anything. But I have to learn a lot in able to be able to design like a bank account.
Yeah.
So it's nice to hear that someone is a product designer and designs products.
It's quite nice to get you on, Tom, because last time out we spoke with James Steiner, which is really interesting to hear that industrial designers don't have to just do industrial design for the rest of their career, but his work was within digital transformation, so it was all about the kind of the apps and all that kind of stuff. So it's nice to get a feel for what life is like for the more traditional product designer, dare I say, just to get a bit more of a feel of how things have generally been. I know you dropped me a line a couple of weeks ago and said it was quite black and white, really. Is that still very much the case?
Definitely is. So on average, I would say the work has gone up. It's gone up a decent amount as well. You know, we're very busy, but we've definitely noticed a trend where some you know, long serving clients have kind of just dropped off a cliff face, and you don't hear from them whatsoever. But then others they've just gone into overdrive and everyone's just, you know, turning the wheel as fast as they can, just trying to make sure that they're still getting product out there, because the demand's still there, you know, and people are still buying and still wanting things. And I guess everybody's turned to Amazon now as well, haven't they? So there's probably never been a greater demand for general consumer products.
Well, I was going to say, is there any sort of trend that you're seeing within the types of products or the types of work that sort of separates those two at all?
So certainly consumer area has gone up in demand for the R&D. We do a lot of work on sort of scientific equipment,
you know,
sort of lower volume products, but have a real niche market. So, and a lot of those come directly out of the university. So someone's been working on a PhD for a few years. They develop this brilliant bit of tech or this brilliant idea. They've had this brilliant idea, but they don't know how to commercialize it or get it to market. So then they'll come to us and then we'll take them through that journey. And I'd say that's probably a good chunk of
our... Do you ever have to tell them that their idea is not very good?
with the university ones, very rarely, because those guys are smart. You can go to a 2-hour briefing and they're telling you everything about their idea and their bit of science that they've done. You can come away knowing nothing more. certainly we do get the odd, you know, one man band would be inventor coming through the doors with I've got a brilliant idea, and I don't have any budget, but it's such a good idea that you're just going to want to take this off me and develop it yourself.
Some sort of Dragon's Den kind of situation. Yeah.
I love that when that happens, when you get, it's like, this is amazing. I've thought about this, it's been on my life's work. You know, it's great. They're so passionate about it. And they've got part of it right. Like, there is a need, but they've gone maybe a little too far in the solution, right? And it can be difficult to dial them back a little bit, right? Do you find that as well?
Certainly. And definitely with companies where it's kind of their first rodeo for getting a product to market, actually a lot of the design process from our end is about not necessarily managing expectations, but trying to pull the reins in a bit to make sure that kind of the core USP for a product isn't lost, because it's so easy to kind of just keep adding features and just let the specification grow and grow and grow.
Yeah.
And you can end up with a monster of a product that's incredibly complicated and really hard to understand. And you lose the really clever bit, because people are seeing that, oh, look, it's a connected Bluetooth Wi-Fi widget that can do this, and it's got speakers here, and it's got a fan here, and, oh, what about if we add an extra bunch of lights over here that can do this? And, you know, another control panel down here.
Oh my God. You're describing a project that I'm working on right now. Where to go? One of the things that me and my team have been talking about recently is about value proposition, and how, like, that's the thing to get excited about in those early days. Understand that there's a problem, but like the solution you're coming up with, There's a value proposition there. There isn't an idea yet, and there won't be for a long time. But right now, there's something exciting that we can start to talk about. And yeah, you're describing so many projects that I've been on. It's fun.
Yeah, so you get to a point there, because you're very much like front end of it.
Yeah.
As it goes through that process, do you find that it's like, hold on a minute, this has gone to a point where it's alien to what it was originally? Do you have to kind of...
Oh, it definitely can.
Yeah
it definitely can, absolutely. But yeah, can it get lost in the front end? Can it get away from the brief? Absolutely. Like, the thing you've got to design first, and the one skill you've got to have, I would say more as you take a leading role, as you get a bit more senior, is being able to define that brief with a client.
Yeah.
Would you say... sort of the digital aspect of design can sometimes hinder it, because sometimes it just kind of sounds like all jargon and, oh, let's put Bluetooth this and light up that. Does it kind of hinder the sort of principle of design at all?
I think it can do sometimes, because it's very easy to add, I guess, kind of like the equivalent of a buzzword, but for a feature into a product, just because everybody else is doing it and it's the norm. And in some ways, you need to do that because, you know, those are the things that make your product accessible and people know how to use them. And that's maybe what they expect from their products now. But it definitely does detract from what's the clever bit that your product does, and why are we doing this, and why are we investing all this time and all this money to get this product to market? And why is this product going to be different from what's already out there?
Yeah. For me, it sounds quite simple, but the idea of a good product is when I look at someone's work and go, well, why didn't I think of that?
Yeah.
And when you go in with that and you come out of it and say, oh, that's actually really clever, it's just almost like a nod of appreciation of, yeah, someone's thought about that and it does solve a problem. And that is just what a good product is. And sometimes the digital element of it just kind of confuses that original purpose, I suppose, of what the product was intended to do, really.
I think it's a really interesting question, a really interesting idea, because to me, it it's like we said, like we've talked about before, it shouldn't really make any difference. The elements and the motivation should be the same, but it's usually so easy to just crib someone's work and, you know, apply a different front door to it. And I mean, it's like
a Me Too product.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, look at Squarespace. That whole business model is built around, yeah, you're not actually going to have much like depth of creativity in this thing, but you can make something very, very good very quickly. And maybe there's an element of that.
Nice plug for our new website there?
I was wondering where it was going.
Oh, that was nice. That was shameful, that plug. That was shameful. by the time anyone's probably listened to this, I'd imagine we might have a new website out.
You'll be getting it free as well.
Yeah, I think I sent it. Did I send it across to you? I've sent it to a few people to see what they have to say. And one person said they had mild anxiety of the fact that our logo, the N and the H, doesn't like line up properly, and it said it gave them mild anxiety. So hoping by the time this is all edited and everything, we'd have removed our flashy pink logo, and we might look a little bit more professional. I don't know.
Well, I like flashy pink logo.
I did it first, but then I thought, maybe there might be people out there that don't like flashy pink logos.
Oh my god! Right, welcome to creative anxiety, Brad. You made something, you showed it to other people, and then you waited for their feedback. And before you heard their feedback, you decided it was terrible.
That's the
reality.
That, it's the closest. That website is the closest thing you'll ever see me get to graphic design. And then you add another layer on that is that your audience are people that effectively do it for a living in one vein or form. So you put that anxiety and then you times it by 100.
I don't think you're ever going to win, Brad. I think you're an uphill and losing battles.
There's always going to be someone out there that's going to do a better job than me, but hopefully it looks all right.
I don't know if there's going to be someone who does a better job. That's not even the real thing. It's always, I mean, I don't know, Tom, if you come up with this as well, but it's the creative confidence and the imposter syndrome. Like,
oh, yeah.
100%. Like in any creative industry, it's affected all four of us. It's affected all four of us.
Yeah, definitely. I can completely 100% relate to that.
I think it's part of the design process. The imposter syndrome is a real thing. You know, and you know, with any kind of design, you're putting some form of expression of yourself, even if it's even if you're doing a mechanical design, there's still an element of you in there.
Yeah.
And whether it works well or not, people are going to judge that, and they're going to look at it, and everyone has an opinion on products. That's the thing, you know. People pick them up, and it can be really small, nuanced things, but it can just rub someone up the wrong way, and then it's hard not to take that personally sometimes.
Yeah, of course. And that same thing that irritates one person could just light up someone's day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
someone else might think actually it's just another wasted piece of plastic that's going to end in our ocean.
That's it. The majority of people won't even notice.
Yeah, so someone else will put it on their kitchen mantelpiece. So, totally get that one. So, Tom, in terms of Oxford Product Design, then, it sounds as if things are busy. Why is that the case, you think? Why are you guys so busy at the minute?
Why are we so busy? Well, I would like to think it's because we do our job very well. So people keep coming back and they trust us. But most companies in product design that I have seen haven't stopped. You know, everyone's continuing on because we know that this isn't going to go on forever. And I think everybody in the design world you've got to have a bit of drive and motivation to get yourself going and to produce anything creative. You've got to kind of have that oomph and will to want to do that. And I think that does just fuel on more design and more progress. Yeah.
Well, it's a new set of problems now, isn't there?
Definitely, yeah. Now we've changed tack on some things as well. We're doing more IP and internal projects. Of our own designs as well. You know, we have more client work than ever, but we're trying to take this opportunity to really develop some of our own thinking. And a lot of that was sparked by COVID. You know, we started off with, you know, doing a couple of quick ideas on how can we do, you know, some makeshift face shields for people, you know, trying to take everyday objects that you have in your house. You know, how can we get something out there just to give people a bit of reassurance that they can leave their home if they need to, you know, if someone's a vulnerable individual and you know, their health isn't the greatest, what can you do if they don't have access to the correct PPE? You know, because for a long time and even now it's still quite tricky to get hold of face masks and face shields.
Yeah, I know one of the big kind of Cambridge firms do that, where they actually kind of, that's part of the business model, is kind of looking at their own IP, because then what they do is they then sell that on to their clients. So they then kind of pitch their idea or whatever to their clients within their portfolio, and it's just another revenue stream for them. But I suppose they have the luxury of doing that with being a larger firm with more resources and maybe a little bit more money in the bank. It's an interesting kind of business model, I suppose.
That's interesting for someone who's like maybe trying to start out. I mean, I know that it takes quite some investment to gain a good IP, you know, a good lock on a piece of IP. But I guarantee it's less than the investment to manufacture something.
Well, obviously depending on the product, but you know, if we talk about the other kind of product design, if it's digital, then surely that's free to distribute, right?
That's
just one zero.
That's a good point as well, actually.
So things are busy. Are they busy in certain areas? Is there that kind of trend of, or is it just generally across the board, they just want to get products out to market as soon as possible? Or is there an actual, have you had companies come to you and say, actually, what you were doing for the last 6 to 8 months with us, scrap that, we want to do this now because of COVID? Has there been much actual core change, or is it just get the other stuff through to market than what was there before?
So with the consumer stuff, we've definitely seen a real push where people want to produce new ideas and more of them.
So
a lot of kitchenware and you know, products for the home, vacuum cleaners and coffee machines, those sorts of products. And there's some real innovations that are going on. But we do a bit of work in the medical field as well, and they're existing clients, but they're kind of just ticking on kind of as they were. Just wanting to kind of keep the wheel turning. The real change we've seen, so one of our biggest clients, they work in industrial products, so in PPE. We do a lot of work with those guys in sort of hard hats and face masks, that sort of thing. And, you know, they're rightly so, you know, focusing on manufacture, you know, rather than looking at R&D so hard, because it's about getting the product to the right people who need it. And and we've seen a change in their business model as well, where, you know, typically they would sell to the construction industry and that was it. But because there's this shortage, they're adapting the products that they have and they're getting them into the NHS. And it's quite rewarding really as well to see, you know, sort of products that you design for one purpose, but then being changed and adapted so that it can be used, hopefully, to save some people's lives. Mm. Forwards, rather than just to
and also to make some unbelievable banana bread as well in the kitchen. Yeah, I mean, because you're right, because everyone is in the kitchen a lot more now. Everyone's at home. Yeah. I know a colleague of mine that over in Australia, Paul, does a lot of work with them, with Breville, for example, and they had a huge uptake in sales, which they just were not anticipating at all. It's just whether is that a short-term increase or is that a long-term thing? And I suppose that's what you have to weigh up as a business, is whether it's just a short-term uptake of everyone making banana bread or everyone's going to want to have a Breville in their home now. It's that kind of combination of the two.
I mean, it's interesting. I've seen a lot of design researchers, and I'll mention him and I'll check whether he's all right with me saying his name. Well, my friend Vish over at Method, actually, as well. I met him when he was working at Method, but Vish Chopra, he's a design researcher, and I saw a thing that he put on LinkedIn today about this being the biggest recession in 300 years. Currently, like, okay, that's going to have that's potentially going to have a much bigger impact on our industry and on virtually every other industry you'd imagine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, what could turn out to be, I mean, who knows, but it could turn out to be a few weeks of, you know, stay at home versus, okay, industry is finished. Like, things will have to change.
It's the unknown of what's going to happen afterwards, right?
Yeah.
There's going to be this huge recession that comes about, but I guess it's all about the bounce back and how quickly do things go back to normal, or can they go back to normal?
Yeah.
And do we want them to go back to the way they were as well? You know, will this have a bigger cultural shift in people's minds?
Was you working in the last recession, Tom, in 2008? Was you?
No, I was a lowly student.
Was there anyone within the business that was around during the recession? Or I know you're quite a new organisation, but I'm just interested just to see what people did. I mean, I was at school in the last recession. I saw the impact of it on a playground, not on a business level.
The more I think about it, the tail end of the financial crash when I was doing my placement year, and I was at PTC, the guys who make
Creo.
Creo, exactly. And it was quite. Quite an unusual time for kind of your first experience of the workplace, where half the team were made redundant. But as a student, they'd already signed off your budget. So you stayed there kind of, you know, up until the end of the year, and you're watching people who've kind of had 20 year long careers. And I remember that being a very strange time.
Yeah. In the current situation, has there been talks of redundancies or furloughing and that kind of thing? Is that something you guys have looked at or know of colleagues? And
not for us. I mean, we obviously talked about it internally when everything was first kicking off. You know, how are we going to manage this? What's the action plan? What do we need to do? What do we need to get in place? And we were all kind of braced, ready for everything to just stop, basically. Mm. You know, that was kind of our initial thinking. And you kind of always live with that working in consultancy anyway, I think, because
it's up and down, isn't it?
Yeah. We have long-standing clients that we do, you know, really long projects with, but commitments generally tend to be, you know, a few months long at best. So everybody always wants to do a rain check, see where we are, and then we'll carry on. And actually it just kept going and started getting busier and busier.
Mm.
But as you say, is this a short-lived thing? I guess we'll just have to wait and see, because until we know what happens when lockdown starts to be lifted, I think that'll be the real test of how is the industry going to look going forward. Mm.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I guess when you enter periods of uncertainty, those that are agile and flexible will always be able to, you know, pivot and adjust and go with the new normal and create the new normal. It's just that's so much easier said than done.
Yeah.
And whatever your organization is, you know, what does that look like? What does that entail? What changes do you need to make? You know, do you take the pain up front to ease it later on? Or do you just kind of store up all the acorns to hope to get through winter?
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. I don't propose to know the answer.
What was quite bizarre in kind of February, March time, talking to businesses at the time, it was remarkable just how many were just quite oblivious to the impact of this thing.
Mm.
This won't affect our business. And you just, I'm not an epidemiologist or I'm no scientist, but even I can understand if everyone's in their home, they're not going to be buying your product, or they're not going to your the retailers aren't going to be buying it. That's quite an obvious
thing.
Is that just smoke and mirrors, or do people generally just not think it was going to impact them?
Well, we had our divine leader going into hospital, shaking hands with people with COVID.
It's staring us in the face, isn't it?
You know, here's this big thing that's going to impact everybody's lives. But don't worry, we'll just carry on as normal. Very odd message to receive.
We'll just be British about it. We'll be fine.
Yeah. We love a good queue. We'll be all right.
What advice have you got, Tom, for those that, and I know we've got a few listeners of people that are on furlough at the minute, that are kind of scratching around, have been for a long time, pretty uncertain about when the furlough's going to end as well. I'm on furlough myself, so I know that feeling. What advice would you give for anyone at the minute that's trying to hone their craft in a period where, you know, the next paycheck could be the last one?
For sure. And it's really tough. And I've got some very good friends, you know, who are very talented people, and their work has just totally dried up.
Mm.
You know, one of my best friends is a fashion designer for the film industry, and obviously that's just disappeared overnight. You know, the day everyone was told to go home, they all got their notice sent to them. And that was really tough for people. But what I've learned from her and other people in similar situations, it's about keeping yourself busy, definitely, but practicing some of the skills that you already have, making sure that you're keeping those sharp.
Yeah.
And so, and whether that's adapting those to new situations. So she's moved into making scrubs for the NHS, you know, to charitable cause, something that you can kind of at least keep your eye in.
Mm.
But also, I guess it's a brilliant time to keep your portfolio up to scratch. And I'm sure people have been told to do that, and they're probably sick to death of being told.
Yeah.
Working on that portfolio, mate.
Yeah.
And also, I think just keep learning, because that's the main thing I get out of work and my job, is that every new client is an opportunity to learn something new.
Yep.
So I think that's really important, that try and maintain that where you can. So, look at those free training courses that are about now, and use the opportunity while it's there, because you're probably not going to get a chance like this again.
No, I think you're exactly right. I mean, I've even done the same myself, and I'm not on furlough. I mean, I actually would like to hear Brad's thoughts on the furlough as well, but no, I've been working full time as normal, unaffected, but. You know, you've also got this opportunity to learn more. As you say, that can go one of two ways. That can be in, especially in industrial design, in broadening your skills and your interests, and looking at those core skills and, you know, how could I apply them in different ways? Should I learn about architectural drafting? Should I learn about philosophy? These are all things that you touch upon within the industry or within the profession, or do you just, you know, deep dive, do you learn how to make a kick-ass YouTube channel?
or an unbelievable industrial design podcast.
This is a perfect example of, you know, what to do with your time, you know, if you can't do your normal job anymore. And I think it's great that you've taken time out of your day to do this and kind of diversify your skill set. And I think that is the real key to this going forwards. If you are in a furloughed situation,
it's
you can hone the skills that you've already got, but I think the ones who diversify as well, I think they'll be the ones who really benefit coming out of this.
Fingers crossed.
On that, Brad, we haven't really talked about this on the podcast, but you know, Wynn mentioned it a couple of weeks ago, or whenever, or maybe a month, maybe it was in, I don't know, a distant time. But yeah,
the time when we could go outside. Remember them days?
Like you and I talked about this in what was it, like January, December. I know I was new into this apartment when you and I spoke on the phone about doing a podcast and about you wanting to create this community. But again, this has given you this opportunity to do it. And I think I think what you've done is a really good example of of furlough behaviour and of what to do. And this is an opportunity. Do you want to talk about that? Because you're always the one asking the questions. But
I personally have an issue with the scheme itself. And I don't know if other people on furlough have a similar issue with it, is the fact that I can't do any work, but I don't really understand why. It's almost, I feel like I'm like a football player that's been put on loan to the government and they're just putting me on the bench all the time and they're not playing me, and I don't really understand why I'm not getting in the team.
Okay.
That's just a personal, I might be completely wrong in saying that, but it just seems like, I feel like I should be able to do my job, but the government for a period of time pays a percentage of my wages. And at the end of that time, they decide whether, just from an economic standpoint, it would be far more productive if I was doing recruitment than it is if I was doing a podcast and putting some sort of logo together. It's just that for me just seems a more productive thing to be doing. And one of the most bizarre things about the scheme is, and it's for me, it's quite cautious in the way that I go about doing this podcast, is I'm not allowed to speak to any of my clients. I'm not allowed to engage with them. And I'm quite cautious about getting certain people on the podcast because it can be perceived that I am in theory doing work in one form or another.
Okay.
So it's a bit of a bizarre time really to be on the scheme, and I'm sure other designers feel it in a similar way. I've had messages come through from people that were made redundant, and why didn't you just put me on the scheme? And that there's that kind of moral dilemma as well, which has been really frustrating for people. It seems to be that I think come the end of July, where it gets to the point where employers have to start sharing the costs, and we still don't know what percentage of the costs they have to share, that will be the point where either you see, hopefully, the market pick up, and hopefully the virus itself will be under a little bit more control, or it'll be a case of, unfortunately, we're just not in a position to keep me, or there's 8 million people on the furlough scheme. It's a quarter of the working population. That's an extraordinary amount of people.
Wow.
It's 8 million people. So
I think what I struggle with the furlough scheme is that it's very polarizing. It's kind of you're on it or you're not.
Yeah. Wow. And what I've started to find, Tom, is an almost a resentment to being on the scheme, mm-hmm. in the sense of, and maybe other furlough people have felt this, and feel free to drop comments or whatever, but it's that case of someone's kind of, it's taxpayers' money, and we're paying for you to be effectively sat at home, but we can't do anything. Okay, we can do a course, we can hone our craft in whatever way, but you're not really making a positive impact to the business. So it's that case of, you're on furlough. To people that are on furlough, it's that case of, okay, so you're potentially more important to the business than what I am. You're still there and I'm not. So it's that kind of, it demonstrates a kind of a hierarchy for some, which you'll find that quite confusing. It's very much business by business kind of case, but I just, the scheme itself, whilst I think it's amazing and quite frankly, a very non-conservative policy, quite left-wing, which I find quite brilliant really from my own personal kind of beliefs, I just feel that it could be done just a little bit better, in the sense of it'd be great to actually still be able to make a positive impact to the business that I'm working for, and I'm kind of just sat on the bench at the minute and hoping that someone scores a goal to get us through to the next round, which is just it's just quite frustrating.
I mean, that's interesting. You raise a good point there, because there seems to be a neglect for the human at the centre of this. And I mean, all right, so I've banged on about this enough before, but being as much of an industrial designer, I'm a human-centred designer. And that is, you know, that's my set of professional beliefs. But, yeah, by the things that you've described and by the position that being on Furlough has put you in, it seems like that's probably it's probably quite transferable to at least a good percentage of the other 8 million people that you mentioned. Mm. And that's maybe not constructive. You know, that there's a big oversight when you leave the humans out of the service.
Yeah. And it's weird because it is Mental Health Week, isn't it, this week?
Yeah.
I know you're quite passionate about the subject, Tom, yourself. And I'll be honest, I think I'm 9 weeks into this now, with this lockdown thing. It's not fun. It has a 2-3 day novelty shelf life to it, and then you get bored really, really quickly.
Yeah.
This time last year, I was up a mountain in New Zealand because I needed to take some time off because I was incredibly burnt out from my job and the hours that I was doing and time that I was putting in. And now vice versa, I'm itching to get back. It's a real kind of extreme of emotion. And anyone that's on furlough, as soon as you start losing that structure of what you do, realise just how important it is to anyone, as a matter of what line of work you're in, really.
Yeah.
There's also the risk of burning out once you start working as well, because you'll be so overwhelmed after, like you said, 9 weeks of not working. There is that definite risk of overdoing it when you actually are able to.
Yeah, it's quite a pressure job as well. It's quite a pressure job, recruitment, and it is nice to hear Tom say things are busy rather than, shit, we haven't had any work on for the last couple of weeks. It does get a slight
change our behaviour. Because we've been really busy, but are we still employing?
They're two different things, aren't they, Tom? It's that kind of I'm busy, but also hiring. Then you've got to factor in, okay, bringing someone in. You know as well as I do, it's not an easy task. To bring people into an organisation, it's actually quite difficult to do recruitment within industrial design.
On during lockdown,
like
one started, I think, a week before lockdown.
Yeah,
another joined us sort of 3 weeks in, and it must be really tough for those guys because you know they've not had the social integration, and that's really important within a business. And if you're suddenly going into, oh, this is everybody. We all live on Teams. You don't get that tactility that you do when you meet someone, you know, and you sat with someone in an office and you're kind of there, and you just, everything does much drier because you don't have those kind of small.
Yeah, we had Wynn on. I don't know if you listened to the episode with Wynn Jones, and he's the design director himself, and that was one of the questions we asked him. You know, how do you build a culture when everyone's stuck looking at a computer screen all day long? How do you do that? How do you get those three new starters feeling part of an organisation? That's how it grows, isn't it? So I imagine that must be quite tough, Tom, to get these three people really embedded into the business.
Yeah, I mean, we've tried. You know, we've set up we have a computer games night. You know, sort of once a fortnight and things. You know, just to try and get people to. Just try and let their hair down a little bit, really.
Mm.
Yeah.
We've talked about doing quizzes and all those things, but everybody is sick to death of doing the quiz. No one wants to do that. You don't want to do family anymore, let alone with your colleagues.
And
we can do these things, but they definitely do feel like sticking plasters, and there is a real replacement for human contact, I think, you know, and just being in the same room as someone else is a very different prospect to being online as we are now. You know? I'm not physically in your guy's bedroom that I can see. You're in my conservatory.
so in regards to kind of mental health, if we kind of stay on the topic, is that something that at the start of your career, was it something that was on the, even for you as well, Emma, is it something that was something you ever really gave much thought about, or is it something? Is it a recent thing that's you've gone? Yeah, maybe I need to think about more about my mental health, because it's very much out there now in terms of that acceptance of having a chat about it. But is it something that you were thinking about at one point or another in the early days?
I'd have to say it's hard when you're entry level, you know, like straight from university, you say yes to everything because you want to kickstart your career. You sort of put everything above your mental health. And then, like, 5 years on from that, every year it kind of seeps in more and more, like, no, you need to start saying no, you need to start putting yourself first on some occasions. And I think, personally, the further in my career I go, the more prevalent it is, and the more I realise, no, this needs to take precedence. I don't know if you agree, Tom.
Definitely, definitely, yeah. When you first start out, you know, you've got this abundance of energy, you know, you're a bit limitless when you're 21. It's kind of your invincible years, aren't they? But certainly, the older I get and the more experience I have of, you know, looking how a project's going to turn about, and you can start to see this is going to be a big one. You know, this is all starting to ramp up. I've been here before, and you have to start developing those tools to build a bit of resilience to those projects as well, so that you know, actually, this is where I need to step back a little bit, because I can feel that I've been doing, you know, 4 or 5 weeks of 12-hour days, and actually, you've got to take your foot off the accelerator, because otherwise, you're not going to be effective by the time you get to the end of the project.
Yeah.
Is that why so many decide to leave out? I've often found in recruitment that designers tend to leave a job after the end of a quite significant body of work. Is the mental health aspect of it play quite a part in that, in the fact that it's almost like I don't think I want to go through that again in my current place, and I want to go somewhere else? Does that play a part or not?
I think it must do, and I guess there'll be differences between agency work and in-house work, for sure. Yeah. And I've done both, so I've kind of seen both sides of the coin.
You was at Hornby, wasn't you?
I was at Hornby for it, for a good number of years. So
Here, isn't it? Down Kent way.
In sunny old Margate.
Oh, nice.
It's come up in the world, I believe, since I was there.
We have in Margate, there is the... one of the best pizza places in England on Market Seafront. Nice. A place called GB Pizza. I'll give you a quick shout out.
Free pizzas now. Free websites and free pizzas.
Yeah. Nutella Doubles. They're the ones. I don't get to speak to many people that are down here in Kent in product design. It's quite nice to speak to someone.
There's not a huge amount of companies.
No, Zach Coley's are down here, isn't it? But other than that, it's not an awful lot. Down here,
I'd say to both questions. I think, again, I've been in house and at agencies, and when a big project finishes, and at some in house places they can take years, and we're talking like 2-3 years for just your section of it, and especially if that's in medical devices or something like that. That release afterwards, you do have a period where you're not burdened. So if you I've completed something that could go in my portfolio now, you just kind of like look a bit further beyond your desk, let's say. So I think there's that's natural. And then
is the next bit afterwards then just doing kind of reiterations of the product?
No. I mean, it could be the next type.
Do you kind of instantly just go on to the next one, or are you at just?
I mean, ideally, if a company's R&D in house structure is right, you shouldn't really have that. Like, okay, one project done. What next? Next one done. Next one. It should be more like we're developing these type of things, and we can cherry pick how to bundle those up. In order to, you know, address a certain set of user needs. Like if you're especially if you're in medical devices, or if you're in, I say just medical devices, but it applies there. Maybe it's more around if you're in an R&D facility that makes one set of products and you're maybe addressing different types of users, and what you're the way that you meet those is through kind of a modular design based sort of technology stack approach or something like that, then really you should have like a lot of the principles that can apply to the same thing. So you should be able to have that continuous flow through a pipeline. But more often than not, it's very much, right, let's design this product and do nothing else and think about nothing else until we hand it over and it goes into, you know, market transfer. And then let's start from zero. And sometimes, yeah, the prospect of starting from zero, you just go, like, I'll start from zero somewhere else.
Yeah.
And I guess that there's less to lose there as well, isn't there? You know, because you're not invested in that project anymore. I sometimes wonder when a project finishes, whether you have a bit of a grieving period for that project, you know? Especially if it's one that you really enjoyed while you were doing. And sometimes there's a bit of a twinge of sadness where it's like, I'm not going to work on that anymore. That was a really good one.
Do you ever notice, like, which types of projects or which type of products or anything like that when you get those attachments?
Yeah, it's definitely ones where you, at least for me, where you're making some marked difference or improvement to someone's life. Mm. And for sure, you know, it very rarely comes from consumer products. It's generally, you know, devices that change the way someone's going to view the world or be able to interact with things. So those are things that really get me going as a designer.
Yeah. Did you always feel that way?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So even from uni, that was the kind of kind of taste for products, should we say, it doesn't evolve over time. You have a clear kind of, I want to work on something that's going to save someone's life, and
definitely
that's the mantra. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's always been there, and I think those are the, I guess they're set on your kind of core beliefs as a human, right?
Yeah.
They're the things that kind of get you up in the morning and why you want to go and design that new widget or that new product or, you know, that device that's going to strap to someone's leg.
Yeah.
Help them move a bit better.
And do you find the same as well? Because I guess, like, because you're obviously creating something for somebody that will be deeply personal for them.
Yeah, well, we design for healthcare. So it's mostly care homes and extra care schemes. And when we do sort of refurbishments, by the way, I work in interior design, in case you don't know, Tom, in case you think I'm just talking about, I don't know. But when we do refurbishments and you actually get to hear firsthand, like the comments from the residents, and most of them are quite positive, because obviously who doesn't want a facelift in their living room, you know? And that is when it actually feels quite well. That's when it feels rewarding. Mm. Yeah, I kind of get what you mean with you feel that kind of sadness, like, oh, it's done now, you know.
Yeah.
And that's when I feel it. Like, for example, we did one, like a local one, last year, and I went to the open day, and an old lady came up to me and said that it felt like she lived in a hotel. And that to me just felt so so worthwhile. It made all those years of stress kind of worth it. Yeah. Like, it just melted away.
Yeah. That's nice.
You forget the hard bits as well when you get that bit of feedback as well, you know, when you can kind of see actually the real positive that product or that room that you designed, when it changes someone's mood and it makes them feel a bit better.
Yeah.
You do tend to forget that, oh yeah, we were up until 2 a.m. on that one.
Yeah.
Brad, you must get that too as well though, right? Because like you literally change people. Well, I mean, let's not go overboard. Not single-handedly, but you know, you're making those connections, you're enabling people to change their own lives.
Well, Matt and Will that we had on in our first episode, they would never have met each other if it wasn't for the fact that I got them both a job in Hong Kong. They wouldn't have spent all those years together. Equally, I have There is a story. I probably should tell the story, but I found someone a job in Australia once, and she was working within Human Factors. I won't say her name, just in case she does listen. Because yeah, she will know. And I always remember this one because I remember calling her one day. And if you ever find a job for someone overseas, you've basically got to try and make sure that everything is right. I remember someone not taking a job once because the company didn't want to move their cat. And you know, there's so many bizarre kind of stories that kind of happen.
Yeah.
And I remember just mentioning, like, you know, is the boyfriend okay? You know, what does he do for work? All that kind of stuff, just to make sure that this person is going to get on that plane. And by her accepting this job in Australia, she dumped the fella. And I always remember that as just a kind of...
your job over her boyfriend.
Yeah, and I always remember that one in terms of I've actually broken a quite a long-term relationship there. which is something that you don't really see on job ads for recruiters and things like that. But yeah, it is funny. And it is the people that make it. It's the people that make the job, because the job is brutal. You know, we talk about mental health in recruitment. I don't know what it's like in design, but I have literally seen people break down at a desk and, you know, start sobbing and crying, and then just because they just can't, they've had an offer turned down or something, and they are back at that point zero. And it's happened so many times that they physically and mentally can't get themselves back into that place where it's right, I've got to go and find someone else. You know, it is, in all seriousness, a horrendous job for your mental health, I'll be honest with you. But there are times when it is the most amazing job ever.
Yeah,
I spent 4 or 5 months up a mountain last year because of the opportunity of being in recruitment for so long and kind of the financial stuff that it gave me. So, it's a real tricky kind of balance, I suppose. But I always remember that one of the one in Australia where she dumped her fella for the job. That's candidate loyalty for you right there. I like that.
Damn, that's heavy.
Yeah,
I guess it's the same as anything, isn't it? Like, you know, if you've got a pursuit, if you're something where you're investing a lot of yourself, those wins are massive, and those times when it doesn't turn out can be hard to cope with. Like for me, I read a lot of like Brené Brown and Naval and all the things that, you know, all the podcasts tell you to read, right? So yeah, nothing novel there. But I tend to find that the way that particularly Brené Brown lays things out and explains things, it is like my internal monologue having a conversation with itself and making sense of the world. And things of those, like those investments into something, You have to do that. You have to dare to do that and be vulnerable and be willing to take that on and recognize going into it that that you are putting yourself out there and that you're being brave and that you're, to use her language, entering the arena and that you're going to get in the dirt and that you're going to get your ass handed to you. You're going to get your ass kicked many times over throughout your career.
If there is, you talk about books there. There is a book that, I can recommend someone to read. I'll show it to you here. It's a book called Invisible Women. And I don't know if you've ever read this book. And it's about how the world is designed for men. And it's one of the most interesting books. And considering that I love the analytics on our podcast, and basically something like 91% of our listeners are male, for example, which I find quite fascinating. So it's about how the world is designed for men, and it's really, really interesting. So if we take your iPhone, for example, the average woman's hand will struggle to unlock the phone and click this little button here at the same time, because their arms aren't big enough. And it's little examples like that show that the product is probably more designed for a man than it is for a woman.
I thought that phones were just too big.
And it is really, really, and it talks not just about products, but also kind of the way kind of architecturally things are designed. And it's really, really interesting. It will frighten the life out of you, Emma, but it is a really, really good book.
Floor space at the moment bloke as there are female ones, right? Which is ridiculous because blokes stand up to have, you know, to go to the loo.
We
take up half the amount of space.
Yeah.
And have twice the amount of toilet.
Yeah, it's a really good book. So, and also, if we can somehow get more than 10% of our viewership to be women, I think that would be quite it'd be quite nice to kind of readdress that balance a little bit.
That's a very similar statistic to the amount of women that are in engineering in general. So, you know, it's always been a problem. It's not something I've noticed change drastically over the last 10 years.
Because you've got quite a good balance within your team, haven't you? Because I know Julia's still there, or was there. I remember Julia when she came over from Oz.
Yep, we're still with Julia. We've got Olivia as well. But it's still predominantly
male
designers. And it is something that we talk about and we want to try and bring more women into the industry. But it's also it's a kind of self fulfilling prophecy if the people coming out of university aren't there as well.
Yeah,
pretty tricky. So it has to happen from the ground up, and we have to get more people interested in design and engineering from school and get them excited about it.
It's a strange one, isn't it? Because if you're interested in creative things when you're children, I'm 30, nearly 38. So my view on the world of youth and education is probably not accurate anymore. But I do think there's still a design tech, home ec split. But Emma, what do you think? Because you grew up in the same sort of area as me, doing like in the WJEC, right?
Yeah. I always knew I wanted to be creative, but didn't know what kind of creativity I wanted to be. And I kind of never had that guidance from school, I didn't think. And I felt like when it came to design and technology, it was mainly male. Like, I took art because I thought design and technology, that's a man thing, you know? Which, you know, when you're 16, you don't think. I think it was just never really... It was never really encouraged. And it's a shame because I think knowing what I know now, I probably would have taken more design and technology over art, maybe. I think it's something, again, we say this every episode, but I think it's something that, again, needs to be discussed more in schools.
Yeah. Or I would also say, like to counter that, if you're listening to this and you're not sure what you want to do, no matter what, if you're 16, you don't know what you want to do, don't do anything. Just wait. You're 16. Go and just run around.
Exactly.
Have you been to New Designers? Or?
I've never been. I was never invited. I would love to go, and I would love to take my whole team and go and just wander around and with no agenda, just go and have a look. I think we should do it every year. I think anybody who's got a design team and you're in house or you're at an agency or whatever, just go and have a look. We should go.
So how are they? Is it just cancelled permanently, Tom, or what's the situation with New Designers? Then is it?
So I try to go to the Loughborough degree show every year, just to see how it's changed and all the new grads coming through, and mainly just to give myself kind of like a bit of a heart attack and go like, oh my god, like these guys have just come out of university and their portfolio is way more impressive than mine. 10 years of real projects.
Do you get the fear or do you buzz off that? Like, does it, or is it a bit of both or something?
When I first see it, I always get a bit of a flutter and I think, oh my god, what this is. I can't compete with some of it now. It is, the industry's changed quite a bit and the skill set that students are coming out with now. They've had 3 years to practice new tools that, we only get to practice them, if a client needs that specific tool. Whereas, people are coming out now and they know how to wireframe an app, coming out of university. And these were things that we talked about when we were there, you know, the iPhone just came out as we were leaving, and we could see that it was the future, you know, that everything was going to go this way, but it was still very much the world of a software engineer to do that app development. It was never really considered that actually it might be the industrial designers going through that thought process and developing, or at least helping to develop, that digital product as it is now. But going back to the degree show, I believe that what they're going to do this year is they're going to set up, you know, a digital platform for everybody to go and see. I guess it would just be like flicking through the degree show booklets,
right?
You know, but just an online portfolio. And I do worry that that's going to hamper and hinder a lot of opportunities for people coming out of university this year. And I really hope that the universities are thinking about this really strongly and working out how they can make good accessible platforms for students to have their soapbox, to be able to talk about the work that they've done over the last 3 years, and to impress potential new employers.
Is there not a way where you could almost do it like what we're doing now, and you get some industry heads together, you put them on a Zoom call with the students, and then you just put it up on YouTube of them giving, you know, this is my product, this is what I've been doing for the last 4 years. You get someone that probably knows a little bit more than someone like me that's in the industry that can ask a few technical questions. They have their little 5 minutes, and then you just put it up on YouTube for well to see. But I suppose there are 3,000 students, aren't there?
So that's the thing, and that's what you miss. So you know, even just going around the Loughborough show, there's what 120 stalls there, and if you were to talk to every single person, you know, you'd have to go for a couple of days to be able to learn about everyone's project and what they've done. So you do some self-selecting as you're going around, and some things look brilliant in a book, but when you see them in real life, they don't have the same, you don't get the same feels from them. And vice versa, you know, some things that are fantastic to hold and touch, actually sometimes then when you step away and you look at it as an item in a catalogue, you then start to analyse it a bit more, and you think, actually, well, what is the real clever bit about this? It was a really nice prototype, and it was, you know, it felt just like the real thing, but did it have anything unique about it? No, I think unless you can be there, again, it comes back to this whole thing of, you know, losing that human connection and personability. Make a real big difference, and I'm a bit worried for that.
Have you got any examples? Any particular projects you just remember where you thought, "Wow, this is amazing"? Are there any ones that ever spring to mind where you always go, if someone said to you, "What does a good grad project look like?" So and so did that thing. It always resonates with me. Or are they all quite samey? Because I find lots of graduate portfolios all just kind of look the same, really.
There's definitely always like a few standout people every year. When I think back to last year's show that we went to, there were some people that were trying to develop medical device products, and they were highly convincing. You would look at some of these models, and at first glance, I would look at them. There was this one product. I think it was for applying droplets into the eye, and we looked at the model on his desk, and we thought, that's a bloody nice prototype. Like it looks like the real thing. And then he picked it up, and then he actually squirted a little droplet out of it. And I thought, you clever bugger! That's you know, wasn't just a nice looking model. It's a nice looking working model as well. And you know, it's things like that I think you won't get unless you're there and you're walking around and you happen to see someone describing their product to somebody else, because somebody else has different questions and different thoughts to an item to you.
Yeah,
and you join in into someone else's conversation. and you piggyback off it. And
how often are you at exhibitions? Because I always see every agency say, "Oh, come see us at this show," and then 1 week later they're somewhere else, and it's like, "Come see us here." And it's like, how often are you actually out and about on the road? And is it one of those things you do for the sake of doing it, or is it actually a really good kind of revenue stream for any agency?
It's really hard to say what the direct impact is on revenue.
Yeah.
But it definitely does make a difference going to shows, because it's again, it all just comes back to people, and it's just about.
It's like quite an old school thing to do, though, from an outsider, to kind of physically go somewhere and set up a stall. If someone was to do that in recruitment, for example, I'd say that just seems a bit outdated to do that. But maybe
that's the whole notion of LinkedIn. It's a continuous affair.
Yeah.
You know, straightened hair. fake tan and nice lighting, and that is literally just the recruiters,
and everything's great.
I'm looking directly at you now, Brad.
You with your straightened hair and your fake tan.
Yeah.
Trust me, I wish I had straight hair and fake tan. But going back to that, in terms of new designers, then should designers really? If you're one of the 3,000 that's watching this, use the time. Maybe put a quick video together on whatever of your project. Chuck it up on LinkedIn, and people will probably get behind that as a bit of a, you know, someone's tried something different, and you might actually get more exposure that way than you would do traditionally by waiting for someone to come around your stall.
Definitely. I mean, the ones that are going to stand out this year are going to be the ones that can make a brilliant digital impact.
Hmm.
And that's going to be really tricky for some people, because some people are all about hands-on sketching and making models.
Yep.
And I think they're going to find it tougher this time round over somebody who whose, you know, hobby on the side happens to be photography or videography or whatever, and they've already made some vlogs, and they're not shy about coming on a web chat.
All kids want to be YouTubers these days anyway, Tom, don't they? They should be.
Start with the grade show a little bit.
That's an interesting point, though, like including your other interests and your other hobbies. And if that's something that's, you know, a different creative pursuit, and I know that we've probably talked about this before, but I do think it's important that if you're a designer, in order to keep that creativity right at the front, you know, if you're playing guitar, going skateboarding, you know, making paintings or pictures or sewing, I don't know what, but like I sort of want to see that as well, you know, when I meet a new designer, or when I meet someone who or a new to me designer anyway, I want to know what else they're into.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's one of the first things I look at if I see someone that's if I'm looking for someone that's that want for an agency job, for example, Tom. If I see someone that's been in a band, or if I see someone that's been even it might sound bizarre, but someone that's been away to somewhere, because that is client facing. You know, you've had to. There's almost like a graft element. If you've gone out there, you've got yourself a job as you weren't necessarily relying on the bank of mum and dad as a kid. That kind of personal characteristic is something that I certainly look at when I'm looking for people. And it's normally one of the first things that people say is, you know, what does this person do outside of work? I'd say it's probably one of the most important things.
We need to know that we can talk to each other and get on, you know.
Yeah.
Most designers have other hobbies outside of design, but still have some creative spin on them.
Mm.
Yeah.
You can't just be all about work all the time.
Yeah. And the guys that I, or the, well, actually the people that I want to work with that I haven't worked with that I've met, and I won't name them now to avoid embarrassing them, but they're often people that I like have some kind of existential connection with. Like, you know, we're both either from a similar kind of background, or we've got a similar political or belief set, or a similar interest, you know. I think those things are super important, be it creative or otherwise.
Definitely.
It's difficult to get that across on a LinkedIn
profile. People hire people, right? It's not just about how flashy is your portfolio?
100%.
Basically, for instance, what gets you through the door, but, you know, certainly with us, you know, if you could be the best designer in the world, but if you're an asshole.
I would say, especially if I'm looking for a junior position, I'm looking more for, are we going to be able to work together?
Yeah.
Rather than, what have you already done? Like, are you willing to learn? Are you willing to apply yourself? And are you willing to give criticism, take criticism, and compliments as well? You know, the same thing. It's like, it has to be a full two-way open relationship. And it isn't just, like, the portfolio is great. It gives you a reassurance. But I want to get across, I want that profile to be written in their language. My LinkedIn profile now, when I think about it, is, like, it's just gross. It's not my words. It's just what I think LinkedIn wants me to say.
I think my LinkedIn profile has about 8 words on it. If you ever look through my LinkedIn profile, it literally says, I do recruitment. check out my testimonials. That really is what my profile says. So,
all these sort of friendly words that I thought were important a few years ago, and I read it back and I go, what a wanker.
I remember once seeing someone's LinkedIn and one of their job descriptions said something like, I was horrendous at this job, but it taught me that I wasn't good at it. And you know what? I remember it to this day. It was honest.
Yeah.
I remember it. Fair play to him.
Yeah.
I think I'm probably a little bit on your train, Brad, where I think I wrote my LinkedIn profile when I left university. And other than just updating the jobs on there, I don't think much else has changed.
Yeah. LinkedIn's a really funny one, actually. It's one of those social media platforms where, obviously, because of the job, I probably spend too much time on there, but that's just the nature of it. But it's always that kind of weird, people's behavior on there are quite weird. It's either they try and go really formal because they think it's this kind of business. The amount of times I get called Mr. Harper or something like that, which I just find utterly bizarre. Like, talk to me how you would talk to me, not just because of, you know, I might be able to find you a job. I just find it really, really weird.
It's still social media, isn't it? I mean, people forget that, I think.
I think it's starting to break down that barrier, LinkedIn, of being a more social media rather than being that place where you just talk about work. But people's behavior, because of the job that I do as well, I find lots of people are quite... they'll send me a message, but they won't send me a comment, for example, because they don't want to be seen to have spoken to a recruiter. Just in case the boss says, oh, you seem to be quite chummy with that recruiter on LinkedIn. And you've got it. There is that kind of does take quite a long time for you to try and break down that barrier of just because I'm talking to you, it doesn't necessarily mean I want to do business with you or I want your CV.
I mean, that's like when you're in a relationship, but also on Tinder. I'm just on there because I've just done really awesome. I don't know, whatever. It's decreasingly believable.
Yeah, I do find people as a species quite weird anyway, but it's quite nice. Well, thanks for joining us, Tom. I hope you enjoyed coming on. And having a chat with us.
I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. It's been good. Yeah, nice to meet you.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And to our listeners in the Philippines, stay safe.
Big thank you to Tom for joining us and discussing what the industry will look like after this pandemic and how it will have an impact on the new set of designers that will be graduating this year. Another big thank you to you, our listeners, for tuning in again this week. We want our podcast and Design Truth to be an open platform for discussion, and we'd like to connect to you guys as our listeners. Let us know your thoughts. How do you think your career will change because of this outbreak? Has lockdown helped or hindered your creativity? And if you're one of the thousands of students that will be graduating with an industrial design degree this year, we want to hear from you. You can drop us an email to hello@designtruth.co.uk. Catch you next time.